The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Kate Pollack. She joins us in studio. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Vic. Nice to be here.
Kate, you've got a new book out. It's called Ethics in the Gutter, Empathy and Historical Fiction in Comics.
Yes.
And when I first got the book, I thought, Ethics in the Gutter? I'm not a comics scholar. I don't read comics that much. I mean, I do read them now and then, not like when I was a kid. But when I saw the word gutter, I thought it referred to the gutter like, you know.
Like brain
drunk,
in the gutter.
Yeah, the drunk line in the gutter. Let's explain to our listeners what a gutter is before we get into this any further.
Well, the gutter is part of the grammar of comics. So there are certain elements that construct a comics page. They're really different from fiction or poetry or other forms of literature. So with a comic page, you usually have more than one panel, and between those panels are these blank spaces where the reader is invited to some extent, imaginatively project some connection between those panels. It doesn't actually strictly occur between the panels, because you kind of need the information from both panels to connect them. But it stands in as this visual symbol of the power of the reader in imagining this connection.
Mm.
And the gutter itself just stands in for this place of possibility that to me was really exciting when I first really returned to comics as a young adult. I was an avid comics fan as a child and returned to comics in my late teens, early 20s, once I'd successfully gotten through high school and was no longer worried about being cool anymore.
Kate Pollack joins us. She's a professor of English at Wittenberg in Springfield. Kate, comic scholarship, I didn't realize this field existed. Is it a fairly new field? Tell me what it is.
Fairly new field. Comic scholars are a loosely collected bunch of scholars from a variety of different fields. It's a lot of literature scholars, but there are historians and art historians and people from a variety of other fields as well who contribute to it. One of the interesting areas that we have for kind of conversation with one another is the Comic Scholars Listserv out of the University of Florida, which is kind of ground zero of comic studies and comic scholarship. And so it's just a wide variety of scholars from a number of different fields, but a lot of us are from English departments. Although most of us from English departments have at one point or another had trouble convincing those around us that comics were literature like other forms of literature are literature. So that I think a lot of people bonded over that, although we have a really wide variety of approaches. Really, strictly speaking, the field's a lot older in France than it is in America.
Hmm.
And it's been more widely accepted as just another literary form in France than in the United States and in other English-speaking countries. Although we're seeing a broadening of that. I would mark Art Spiegelman's publication of Maus in the late 70s, early 80s as the first time people started taking comics more seriously as an artistic form. Comic scholarship in general, though, started being published more in academic presses in the 2000s.
Hmm. I was thinking maybe just before Spiegelman, that in the late 60s and early 70s when we started having the R. Crumbs and the S. Clay Wilsons and these underground comics, the Zaps, Gilbert Sheldon. That's the kind of stuff that I was reading when I realized that there was something besides Superman and the Flash.
Absolutely. And the underground comics had a really formative effect on the field. Something that's really important to acknowledge, but sometimes those of us who are younger comic scholars or comic scholars who are women, comic scholars of color, push back against, because a lot of those were slightly more
offensive.
I'm trying to dance around this a little bit because I actually just got in a fight on the Comic Scholars listserv about removing R. Crumb's name from an endowed room in a library.
Ooh.
And a number of the kind of older guard of comic scholars took offense to the removal of his name, and several even brought the charge of censorship, and I thought that was just a tad silly. Removing someone's name as an honor isn't censorship. It's simply providing space for maybe another comics artist who maybe was a little bit more inclusive or came a little bit later.
Has R. Crumb committed some sort of retroactive Me Too violation with his depictions of women and et cetera?
Well, his work was satirical, but if the people who he's satirizing don't always recognize it as satire, is it effective satire?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's it, and that's the question, because I mean, no one can dismiss his importance to the field. That would be silly. He's a foundational part of the history of comics. Mm-hmm. But maybe honoring him in some of these more inclusive spaces isn't always necessarily the greatest idea. So I think you need to walk a fine line where you're acknowledging the importance of one of the giants of the fields while also acknowledging the ways in which some of his depictions may make people feel marginalized.
But we digress. My guest is Kate Pollack, and we love a good digression here in the Book Nook. The book is Ethics in the Gutter, Empathy and Historical Fiction in Comics. Why did you write it?
I wanted people to pay more attention to the field of comics, particularly in regards to the form of comics and the concept of empathy. One of the things as I was coming up through my master's and my PhD program that I found a lot of people focusing on, because affect theory is kind of a relatively new area as well, of inquiry into literature and other written forms. A lot of people were talking about the ways that empathy could be taught through literature and taught through various narrative forms. And I was kind of interested in how that worked with comics. And then I was working under Gary Weissman at University of Cincinnati, and I was TAing for a Holocaust literature class that he very graciously allowed me to co-teach on some occasions. And we were unnerved by some of the responses of students to some of the material. So we had we were teaching things like Elie Wiesel's Night and Simon Wiesenthal's The Sunflower, which, if you don't know it, is a fictionalized short story kind of about a Nazi on his deathbed and forgiveness granted and so on. And we were unnerved at the extent to which many students felt that what they were supposed to get out of the class was to adopt the subject position of a victim of the Holocaust and, quote, walk a mile in their shoes. And that was certainly not what either Gary or I intended. We wanted to inform people of how easy it is to slip into these forms of dehumanization. And really, if you should be empathizing with anyone, you should be empathizing more with the perpetrators or with the bystanders than with the victims, because as a reader, to some extent, you're in a position of power over the narrative and over your relationship to it, and you have the ability to put the book down at any point. You're not in this powerless seat of the victim. Mm. And so we had some of these very problematic responses, up to and including a paper that recounted Primo Levi's, quote, overanalysis of Auschwitz as being similar to the student's own, quote, overanalysis of which body wash to use in the morning.
Ew. That's slightly disturbing.
Well, and this was not a bad student. This was not a person who who was a terrible person. This was someone who was doing this very, very awful metaphor, but was doing it because they were struggling with how to deal with the material. Mm-hmm. And then we got to Maus, and the responses changed. And I realized it was partially because of the form. People had the panels objectified before them, and they were aware of the way that they were participating in parts of the narrative, and they were aware of the way that the narrative was separate from them. Mm. We've all had that wonderful feeling. Any readers had that feeling falling into a work of fiction, really inhabiting that world. And that's wonderful, but that can be really problematic in terms of how we figure our own ethics that we're bringing out of the book into the world, especially when you're working with subject matter related to atrocity. And comics do something different. They ask the reader to address them in a different way. And that's what got me really excited about writing this book.
The book is Ethics in the Gutter, Empathy and Historical Fiction in Comics. Kate Pollack wrote it. She joins us right here in the studios of WYSO in the Book Nook, and we'll be continuing our conversation. We're going to get into some of these graphic novels that she examines right after this. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. It's the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to have Kate Pollack on the program today. Her book is Ethics in the Gutter, Empathy and Historical Fiction in Comics. A moment ago, I'm not the only listener who heard this. You referred to affect theory. What the heck is that?
Affect theory is
Affect. Yeah. Affect theory. Okay.
Yeah. And I always overpronounce the A, so it's clear that that we're talking about emotion. And this is one of the kind of the post-structuralist turn that came out of innovations when we wanted to deal with literature more in terms of, say, how colonization changed certain writers' relationship to the world, how gender changed certain writers' relationship to the world. And affect is an attempt to kind of talk back to the ideas of the objective analysis of literature and thinking about the way that texts engage readers' emotion and complicate readers' emotions and introduce more emotions. There are a number of practitioners. Probably the most famous is Sarah Ahmed, who did a book called The Cultural Politics of Emotion that's been very influential. And I'm going to butcher the pronunciation here, but Sien Nye's Ugly Feelings is a really important one that I've drawn from a lot because it's interested in things like shame and disgust and how those can be leveraged potentially for ethical projects, because part of affect theory's assumption is that emotion is to some extent, and not necessarily in always predictable ways, tied to moral behavior in the world. And that might be, you know, shame as an outcome of unethical behavior, or shame as an outcome of ethical behavior in situations in which ethical behavior is viewed as problematic.
You chose some very particular, I should call them graphic novels.
Graphic narratives.
Narratives.
Or comics.
Okay.
I usually just go with comics because it's easiest.
Your first chapter. I know some people say a comic is not the same as a graphic novel or graphic blah, 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 but we won't get into that. Being a Dog, Transformation, Focalization, and Memory in, is it Deogratias?
Deogratias.
Deogratias. I'm not going to pronounce that again. Deogratias. I like that. Okay. I have never read this comic, but it sounds like a very powerful comic. Tell us about it and why you chose it and what this chapter is about.
Deogratias is really the foundation for me of this project. Certainly Maus was my kind of introduction to the way that comics address the reader in a different way. But Deogratias brings in the other aspect that's really important in my analysis, which is historical fiction, because I wasn't interested in memoir. A lot of comic scholars are working on autographics, which is the field-specific term for graphic memoirs or autobiographies in comic form. And I was interested more in comics that fictionalized atrocities. And Deo Gratias, my husband actually got me a copy of it. Ian McDonald, he's a professor at Florida Atlantic University. And it was very exciting because I had always been interested in the Rwandan genocide because I was very young when it occurred, but I remember watching it on the television, being kind of disoriented by the footage and unable to understand what was going on and really unclear on the narrative. And J.P. Stassen, the Belgian but Rwandan emigre writer who wrote and illustrated Deo Gratias, really capitalizes on some of the ways in which the information coming out during the genocide was disorienting and to some extent purposefully disorienting. So it follows the title character, a young man whose name roughly translates thanks be to God, in the period both before and after the genocide. And Deo Gratias, before the genocide, is a pretty normal young man. It would be recognizable to any Western reader. He's mainly interested in trying to bed two sisters. He's interested in getting drunk, and he is mostly just a kind of silly, fun character. And then the genocide intervenes. And in the post-genocide era, he's this broken young man who, when he can't find enough banana beer to kind of tamp down his memories, he is visually represented as turning into a dog. He understands himself as turning into a dog in the graphic narrative. And over the course of the graphic narrative, this becoming a dogness is related to the concept of memory and is related to all of his kind of happy and normal memories before the genocide. So it's clear that there's some kind of break at the point of the genocide that goes beyond a simple, this was an atrocity, this horrible thing happened. He's unbelievably traumatized. And it comes out that he is indeed a perpetrator of the genocide. He's a bystander and has, in fact, engaged in atrocities.
And many people did. This was a huge thing. People don't understand the history of it, but you explain it.
Yeah, just to give you a very, very brief history, I go into this in a lot more depth in the book. Much of the country participated. So there are three major ethnic groups in Rwanda, the Hutu, the Tutsi, and the Twa. The Twa were kind of the original ethnic group in the area. Both the Hutu and the Tutsi had at different points kind of migrated in from different areas, and this is way, way in the ancient past. And prior to colonization, there were already clear ethnic divisions. There was some tension between the groups, but this was purposefully exacerbated by several different colonial powers, including encoding ID cards where a person was noted as either Hutu or Tutsi. And the Tutsi were, for the most part, favored during colonial rule, because they were perceived as being whiter than the Hutu. But this was flipped at the point of decolonization, and Hutu were granted a great deal of power, and the Tutsi population was then marginalized in part because of the resentments that were built over the time of colonial rule. And ultimately, this led to continued tensions, including a genocide that is rarely discussed in neighboring Burundi, which was the Tutsi genocide of the Hutu. But there's a number of complicated aspects to it. But ultimately, Deo Gratias as a comic goes through all of these myths surrounding where this tension came from, including having some characters say that there was this mythic past where the Hutu and the Tutsi were exactly the same prior to colonization, and there was no tension at all, which isn't true. Mm. And also that the Tutsi were horrendous invaders who had enslaved Hutu peasants, which also wasn't true. And so it's really Stassen showing how these myths created resentment before the genocide and persist after the genocide, complicating society. Although I will say Rwanda today is among the safest countries in Africa, is a wonderful vacation destination, has kind of come out of the genocide really committed to peace in a way that you don't often see.
Mm. And one other aspect of that I noted was he keeps turning into this dog. And after the genocide, there were no dogs. It's fascinating.
Yeah, Philip Gurevich, and we wish to inform you that tomorrow we will be killed along with our families, the kind of foundational journalism about the genocide, it describes the lack of dogs as being this vast silence at night in Rwanda. And it's because during the genocide and as the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which was the Tutsi-led force that halted the violence, as they were moving across the country, they found all of the dogs eating the corpses. Mm-hmm. And so it was this public health concern and also just this appalling image that man's best friend, man's loyal companion was in some kind of symbolic sense participating in this great atrocity. And so there were no dogs in Rwanda for quite some time after the genocide because they had all been annihilated along with a great deal of the Tutsi population. The estimates vary between about 600,000 at the very low end to about 1 million on the high end of Tutsi and moderate Hutu killed over the course of the genocide. To go back to your question briefly, a lot of people who participated in the genocide did so purposefully. And some people who participated in it were forced by neighbors to kind of, quote, prove the color of their blood, mm-hmm. which is actually a line Stassen directly uses from some of the broadcasts by the radio program that was partially responsible for amping up the violence and for directing the Interahamwe genocidaires.
Kate Pollack joins us. Her book is Ethics in the Gutter, Empathy and Historical Fiction and Comics. And we look at all these different aspects of empathy and the way the comics are constructed and the points of view. And these are so many things that I never thought about. And I learned a lot from this book. Let's look at Just Like Sally, Rape and Reflexivity in Watchmen. I'm sure we have some listeners out there who are familiar with Watchmen. This has been a big series, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And Watchmen was another foundational comic. Came out at roughly the same time as Mouse. And Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons really produced something magical, something that generations of readers have attached themselves to. And for the people who don't know it, Watchmen follows a group of vigilante crime fighters, one of whom is an actual authentic superhero. Dr. Manhattan actually has special powers after being exposed to a magnetic field, the same origin story as most superheroes. But the rest of them are simply costumed crime fighters. And the plot hinges on a perception of a potential Rorschach thinks that there's a mask killer out to get all of these vigilantes, many of whom have retired. And he's to some extent right and to some extent wrong. It's actually a much larger plot conducted by another character in order to bring about world peace, which it sort of does at the end, but at what cost? Mm. And that's essentially the plot of Watchmen. But there's this very minor point where one character, Sally Jupiter, whose entire shtick is to dress in this very sexy way, but also to, fight crime. She's changing out of her costume, and another costumed crime fighter, the comedian, attempts to rape her. And this is very often thrown off by scholars when dealing with Watchmen, just like this is a plot point. And part of it's treated as the sideline to her Sally Jupiter's daughter's story, Lori, who is the girlfriend of Dr. Manhattan. And it's simply treated as this complicating measure of the plot because it comes out eventually that the comedian is, in fact, Laurie's father, because Sally and the comedian later had consensual sex after this attempted rape. And it always bothered me in terms of a plot point, not because I thought that it was somehow betraying any feminist cause, but because I felt like Sally's story wasn't honestly dealt with by a lot of people. And this became, to me, a much more urgent question when the Watchmen movie came out. And David Hayter wrote a letter basically using this plot point as a way to sort of marginalize fans who objected to the film. He said, "Oh, you'll come back just like Sally."
Ooh.
And it's like, first of all, dude, calm down. Like, it's, people are allowed to have reactions to a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, it felt like a real misunderstanding of Sally's story to me, because she, by her own account, said she didn't know why life led her in this direction, and her later consensual encounter with the comedian didn't erase what he did. It was simply one of the complications of life. Mm-hmm. And so she was able to both hold the resentment for what he did and hold the love for him being there for her in a moment when she actually needed him as two contradictory but not necessarily mutually exclusive feelings. And so that moral complexity of that relationship to me really thought that was the moral core of Watchmen itself, because after all, the question at the end when Ozymandias is speaking to Dr. Manhattan, which is, I did the right thing, didn't I? It all worked out in the end. And Dr. Manhattan responds with, "The end, nothing ever ends." And that to me goes directly back to that question that Sally has: why do I feel both of these things for this man? And I loved the way that it was staged, the attempted rape, because it was asking us to think about our own complicity in the staging, as well as to complicate our emotional reaction because of what comes out later in the comic. So we can't purely think of the comedian as this recalcitrant villain. He's something much closer to a person like we are people. And so is Sally. And Sally's allowed to have those confusing, contradictory, and problematic, and not potentially difficult reactions simply because of her humanity and because we're all continuing to work through these moral questions.
In case you've just tuned in, you're listening to The Book Nook, and my guest today is Kate Pollack. Her book is Ethics in the Gutter, Empathy and Historical Fiction in Comics. I'm Vic McCunis, and we have one more segment with Kate coming up right after this. You are listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today my guest in the studio is Kate Pollack. Her book is Ethics in the Gutter, Empathy and Historical Fiction in Comics. I think the biggest surprise that I got out of reading your book was the realization, I just kind of went, duh, because you have someone you talk about in this book who I've had on the program a couple of times, and I had no idea this person was even involved with comic books. I know her as a fabulous crime writer. She writes tartan noir. Her name is Denise Mina. I've had her on a couple times. I had no idea that she had this side to her career.
Oh, and her run of Hellblazer was fantastic. She was the first woman writer of Hellblazer, and brought in the title of a particular volume that really inspired a lot of my thinking about empathy and the problems with empathy. Because a lot of this book, and I haven't entirely been clear about that while I've been talking, a lot of this book is a critique of the way that people have promiscuous empathetic engagements with characters and how comics leverage that empathetic engagement to prompt self-reflection on who you're actually empathizing with. And Denise Mina's work with Hellblazer was foundational in that respect. Her the run of Hellblazer that she did was surrounding this empathy engine that a man was trying to build, and it's Hellblazer has to do with magic, so like there's a lot that it you have to kind of take on faith. But he's using different geographical features in order to create an empathy engine that will spin empathy out around the entire globe so that everyone automatically feels everyone else's pain, everyone surrounding them. And that's a really, really great idea in terms of creating a more moral world until you realize that you're surrounded with people every day who have done really, really awful things, and maybe you don't want to feel that. And so in this area of Glasgow, which becomes kind of infected with this empathy engine, people are walking around with signs to kind of keep people away from them if they've done something particularly awful, like I'm a child murderer and I'm a wife beater and so on. So because if you come near them, you'll feel as they feel. And the really exciting part of Mina's work in this is how she exposes empathy as this potentially really dark tool rather than the way that we are often taught to look at it as this thing that has only moral benefits and only potentially something that's only something that's potentially positive. And she wants us to think more about that dark side of empathy. And that for me was really magic, especially in relation to the main character of Hellblazer, John Constantine, who's one of the great anti-heroes of comics. And you spend the entire series really getting into his character and kind of rooting for him, except for the fact that he kills, like inadvertently kills most of the people that he comes in contact with. I mean, he's really just a terrible person.
Kate Pollack joins us. She's a comics scholar and a professor of English at Wittenberg University. Her book is In the Gutter, Empathy and Historical Fiction in Comics. And another thing I realized as I was reading this, you keep mentioning Scott McCloud. I had him on the program for his book Understanding Comics, and I didn't understand that comics were a scholarly pursuit at that point. I didn't realize it until I started reading your book. Let's move on to Chapter 3, We're Still Here, Authenticity and Memory and Scalped.
Oh, such a wonderful series that really doesn't get very much attention, especially because it is a series. It's very hard to teach comics in the classroom that are these longer running series. So Hellblazer, you know, ran for 30 years Scalped has, I believe, 10 or 11 trade paperbacks. So it's difficult to because you have to spend a week per trade paperback. They're not dissimilar to novels in that respect. And Scalped is Jason Aaron's take on the Lakota Sioux and the Pine Ridge Reservation. He fictionalizes it as the Prairie Rose Reservation. And it's a retelling of the Leonard Peltier case and trying to work out what actually happened that day through historical fiction. And every time you see this kind of foundational moment in the reservation's history, it's shown from a different perspective, and something different happens. So it's trying to realign how we think of memory, which is one of the other things that really excited me in terms of comics and historical fiction. It can expose more of how memory actually happens. We usually think of memory as this very reliable thing, but all of the cognitive studies are showing that every time we remember something, we're retelling a story and changing it slightly. And this is why, you know, eyewitness testimony is so often flawed and so often can convict people who perhaps did not commit the crime. And what Scalped is trying to do is expose how memory actually works, where you keep telling yourself the story and the story changes based on your present day circumstances. And that's really the function of memory, because memory is not past focused. It's future focused. And that future focus means that the changing circumstances around you are going to alter how you tell yourself that story from your past. There's a kernel of truth there, but that truth changes its relationship to you based on where you are in your life.
Mm. Well, all these graphic novels that you focus on, these graphic narratives in these standalone chapters, are really dark. And that one that we were just talking about is very dark, but I think when we get to chapter 4, that is so dark. My children will remember all of the things I tried to forget. Bayou and intergenerational trauma. Whoa.
Bayou's another I actually get to teach Bayou because it's just two volumes, although there's supposed to be a third volume and Jeremy Love has yet to come out with it. And so the narrative's unfinished, which drives my students crazy and drives me crazy. But it's a wonderful, wonderful account of 1933 Mississippi. And it's essentially a retelling of Alice in Wonderland. It's a Through the Looking Glass story where a little girl named Lee, a black girl whose father is accused of raping and murdering her white friend, Lily. She has to go into the bayou to rescue Lily to prove that her father did not commit this crime. And Lily was, in fact, stolen by this swamp monster, perhaps, who appears as a sort of white man rising out of the swamp. And it's very unclear how much of this is, quote, real and how much of this is Lee's imagination dealing with something that she's seen and can't quite make sense of in her child's brain.
Is that the Gollywog?
Well, there's the Gollywog is another villain.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Go on.
Cotton Eye Joe is actually the one who steals
Lily. Oh, okay.
Lily.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And then the Gollywog comes after Lee. If you don't know what a Gollywog is, it's based on a kind of racist caricature of African Americans that was featured in a children's book in the early part of the 20th century.
You've also got Stagger Lee in that one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all these musical references.
Lovely musical references. Mm. And actually, a friend of ours down at Florida Atlantic, Taylor Haygood, actually just did a paper on Bayou that explores some of the Southern folklore a little bit more explicitly than I really get a chance to in my chapter. And I forget where that publication is. But it's really a very, very rich comic and could really use more people working on it who maybe have a little bit more of the musical references than I do, because I'm purely looking at it from a memory standpoint, because a lot of humanities scholars have been talking for decades now about the possibility of an intergenerational transmission of trauma. And that really came out of the Holocaust, the way in which the second generation, the children of Holocaust survivors, had what looked like trauma, yet had never been exposed to anything specifically traumatic. You know, this is kids who are growing up in the home either hearing about the Holocaust, mm-hmm. or not hearing about it and attempting to reconstruct what happened to their parents with very little information.
Can't you understand how that could be, though? I mean,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
My father grew up during the Great Depression, and I feel like I got depression trauma from him.
Absolutely. And that's so humanities scholars have been talking about it for many years, but it's only very recently that we've started to see some cognitive evidence that this is indeed the case. Mm-hmm. We're seeing actual evidence from clinical psychological studies that shows that some of the ways that that people have contact with traumatized individuals is traumatizing in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly a young girl in 1933 Mississippi whose father's on the cusp of being lynched and has herself seen the lynched body of a young boy and has been just surrounded by racism would certainly experience this. Because once again, intergenerational trauma has been talked about significantly in terms of Holocaust studies, but it's more talked about in relation to slavery and the African-American experience of racism in America in the last 15 to 20 years, mm-hmm. which is really important, I think, because it indicates the ways that the past is not just the past.
Mm. My guest is Kate Pollack. The book is Ethics in the Gutter, Empathy and Historical Fiction in Comics. And as you listen to Kate and you say, gosh, she really knows how to talk about this stuff. Well, the book is beautifully written. And
thank you.
Very, very enjoyable read. It's not too academically obtuse. I think a wide audience could appreciate it. And let's briefly get into this, this chapter 5, Telling the Wound. And wow, are we talking genocide or extermination in this one?
Well, Telling the Wound is, you know, this is actually, it's the last chapter of the book, but it's actually the first chapter that I wrote. And I didn't write it initially in with anything in mind in terms of my dissertation or eventually the adaptation to the book. And by adaptation, I mean full rewrite and then some. So this is another part of Hellblazer, the comic focusing on John Constantine. But it's talking about the genocide of the Tasmanian Aborigines, which was almost complete. And this took place during the Black War in the 1800s. And really, I wanted to include this in part because it's such a moving comic and such an interesting way of telling this forgotten story. And also because I wanted to make sure that I had one chapter that focused on a single issue of a comic, because I focused on two graphic novels. I had focused on a longer running series and had taken things from different points in that series. I had focused on a multi-volume work. But I wanted to make sure that people understood also that comics come in those single little issues that you buy down at the comic store and can tell this full, complete, and moving story and really ask complicated questions of how you engage with that material. And the basic plot is that John Constantine needs information about a different kind of different magical going on in the world. And so he goes to Tasmania to dreamwalk with the Tasmanian Aborigine spirits of those who were killed in the genocide to get information that they might have from their folklore about this other magical going on. And he winds up getting shunted away from the dreaming and dropped in the dreaming of the dead British soldiers who had massacred the Aborigines. And it's this very complex story of who gets access to what stories and when, and to what extent Constantine could have understood their story because of his attempt to kind of force his way into a story he had no right to. And one of the spirits chooses to help him and pulls him out of this dream. And this final line of the issue, it's a really penultimate page of the issue, where he is walking out of the dream. He's following this Tasmanian Aboriginal woman's spirit out. And the narrator says, so he asked her about the shadow dog, and she told him all that he asked, leaving essentially out this space of not knowing perhaps what it was important to ask. And so there's this kind of gaping hole at the end of this comic where it's very clear that Constantine thinks that he's gotten the whole story and, in fact, didn't even know the right question to ask. Mm. And it's, for me, these lines, this page has haunted me since my master's degree back in, 2006 was the first time that I wrote about this, because it's such a compelling question, the extent to which we misunderstand the stories that we're told, we misunderstand the questions that we're supposed to ask, we misdiagnose our ability to fully inhabit the space of another's consciousness. Mm. And it was important to me to kind of end on that note because I want us to continue thinking about the title of the conclusion is The Moving Past, and moving is in parentheses because I want us thinking not only about moving past these atrocities and these difficulties of the past, but also the way in which the past itself is moving in our present and is moving in our memory and is reshaping us as we go forward and is reshaping the way that we interact and the way that we can't quite grasp what the past was as well.
Mm. Well, it's a fascinating study, and we appreciate you spending some time talking to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. This has just been delightful.
It's been our pleasure. The book is Ethics in the Gutter, Empathy and Historical Fiction in Comics. Kate Pollack wrote it, and she is a comics scholar, as you have heard, and she teaches English. She's a professor at Wittenberg in Springfield. One quick question. I know you're working on another book. What is it?
Right now, I'm working on a couple of books.
Okay.
I'm working on a creative work called Top Heavy, which is a graphic novel about America's obsession with breasts.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to definitely have to read that one. Okay.
It's supposed to be both a humorous take and, I'm interested in trauma as well.
Right, okay.
And I'm also working on a study on Holocaust remembrance right now. Uh-huh. And I'm looking at the way that people interact with Holocaust memorials and Holocaust fiction to think through the way that the digital age has changed the way that we interact with the remembrance of atrocity.
Mm.
And thinking forward as well.
We'll watch for those.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO, and Kate Pollack has been my guest. Thanks for listening.